Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another podcast. It's another Wittertainment podcast starring Mark Kermode
and Simon Mayo.
And here we are. And these are the director's bits, added bits, just for podcasters. Because we love podcasters. A lot of them travel and live in exotic places in the world that we would like to come and visit personally.
And I believe almost 500,000 of them podcast every month.
I think that's a very good idea. Anyway, so on this programme,
yes,
I can tell you, actually, because you don't know this.
I don't.
Tell us about the David Arnold song, and then I'm going to update you.
David Arnold will be singing on the podcast. I was at a party with him, and he sang. I said, "Your voice is beautiful. You've got lovely eyes. Come and sing on the podcast."
And we were just... Normally, the rules about music means we can only give you a little bit, but as an exclusive, we can give you the whole thing.
Oh, fantastic.
How about that?
And it's his theme from the Bond movie that wasn't used.
Who else? Not enough. Who else is going to be on the show?
Anton Corbin, the director of Control, the film about Joy Division, and, of course, the director of The American, which is the new George Clooney movie, which, as you point out in the interview, is more racy than one may expect of George. Yes. Although it did remind me that when Solaris came out starring George, because of the butt shot in it, it was referred to humorously in the tabloids as Solarsis.
Yeah, well, you know, and... As you're going to find out, it's a bit like Solaris. We're doing a whole new show here.
Real.
It's an exclusive for the podcasters. But interesting that you mentioned Solaris, because he's about as grim in The American as he is in Solaris.
Really. He is, yeah.
Anyway, more of that with Anton Corbin, because this is the Wittertainment Podcast. Thank you for listening. Here we go. Welcome to the UK's flagship film programme.
Or battleship.
Flagship. Battleship. Can you be the battleship? That has all kinds of
battleship
connotations.
Battleship Wittertainment.
Yeah, but that's a bit grey. Battleship Grey, isn't it?
Have you ever been to Odessa?
Have you watched Battleship Potemkin?
Yeah.
I think we should show that.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Odessa?
No.
Where the Odessa Steps
Where the file comes from.
Yeah, that's right, where the files and the Odessa Steps sequence.
We didn't rehearse this opening, did we?
No, but I thought you were leading me on to that.
2 hours of conversation about film, live. It's an interesting format.
If only we'd thought of it sooner.
Ben James from Nottingham University. I recently discovered the joys of your studio webcam stream. People can watch this rubbish live. It was particularly useful, always has been, in seeing the veins bulge on Mark's forehead mid-rant. However, last week...
Do they bulge?
Yes. When you're at the Phoenix in East Finchley, what we got was 2 hours of empty seats in the Five Live studio. Clearly, Ben watched it for 2 hours. Instead of watching our live stream from the Phoenix, he was watching the webcam feed, which was just two empty chairs.
I believe that the live stream from the Phoenix was watched by something like 140,000 people other than Ben.
Perhaps I'm missing the point, says Ben, but of radio, but the occasional visual aid can be the cherry on the cake. So what can we offer him as a visual enticement today? Well, I suppose David Arnold's going to be
David Arnold will be here. I'm assuming that the cameras are lined up, so they will be able to see him at the keyboard.
that's good, isn't it?
It'd be great.
You're right, the cameras are positioned so that you can't see
David Arnold. But you can see me and Yvie going,
that's good, that's singing great. Along, baby. Waving our arms in a Top of the Pops audience.
You do need to be able to see David Arnold, because one of the reasons that I've persuaded David Arnold to sing is that... I heard him sing recently, and I was really knocked out by his voice. And he said that a friend of his had said, "Yes, I never expected that voice to come out of that face." And you need to see that face to get the full effect.
This is Mark in Earlsfield. Last week, one of your pilgrims said that someone had said, "Hello, Jason Isaacs," at a wedding. This was our big Kiwi wedding, where they'd included him in the kind of thanks to the bride's father, etc. And the bridesmaids, very lovely, the photographer, the vicar, da-di-da-di-da.
And hello, Jason Isaacs.
And Mark says, this got me thinking, perhaps listeners can promise to say those three words at upcoming events. In a few weeks, I'm going to be speaking as best man at my brother's wedding, when I'm going to thank the parents and the bridesmaids, and I will indeed say, and hello to Jason Isaacs. This is going to be a new social trend.
How high up the social chain do you think we can get, and hello to Jason Isaacs?
Well, I think the Queen's speech would be quite good, wouldn't it, at Christmas?
Does she read it off an autocue?
Is it
like Ron Burgundy, that if you just put "and hello to Jason Isaacs" in the Queen's autocue, she'd just say it?
She might say it.
"And hello."
BA Honours. Could you please say happy birthday to David Plant, who is 40.
Happy birthday.
On the 13th. He listens to your podcast religiously. We'll probably be listening this week as he drives alone through France and Spain en route to Morocco in his Land Rover Defender. Midlife crisis, yes. I wish him a safe and trouble-free journey.
Have a safe and trouble-free journey, and happy 40th birthday.
And hello to all the hard-working and never-partying folk of Flat F at Chevin House at Manchester University, which is, as we all know,
the greatest university in the country. And incidentally,
apparently they're just catching a few minutes of the show before returning to their studies.
There was a piece, ironically, in, yes, I think it was in The Independent this week, not the exactly a whole other newspaper, which said that actually Manchester University is the best university in the country because...
In what, paper?
In The Independent.
You never see that.
No, I saw it because somebody said, did you see this? And it was on the basis that it has at the moment, or it is about to have, in one department, the most Nobel Prize winners,
yes,
of any university in the country. Now, obviously, I'm scrabbling for details here. Anyone listening, representing the good folk of Manchester University, just send me a text to confirm just the brilliance of
that.
Well,
they're all listening in...
Oh, you got it there.
Flat F in Chevin House.
Well, everyone in Flat F in Chevin House, get online, find the details, email them in to us now.
Julian, on this email, a brief thanks to the good doctor there for helping me enjoy cinema again. Now, this might sound a bit confusing, but let me elaborate. I used to sit in the middle of the row when I went to the theatre. And for years, I've had one bad experience after another. Every time I went to see a movie, without fail, 1 minute before the feature began, some insufferable idiot would come in, sit right next to or behind me, and then text, and then kick the back of my seat, then talk on the phone, eat with his mouth open, or did a whole number of things that drove me bonkers and ruined everything for me. I was beginning to avoid going to see movies in the theatre altogether. Then, 2 weeks ago, while watching Scott Pilgrim, the guy next to me, true to form, started tweeting on his phone mid-film. Can you imagine? I couldn't take it anymore. I would not let another viewing be ruined by, excuse me, by another idiot. I'm so choked with emotion. Remembering that Dr. K often talks about taking an aisle seat, I took the good doctor's advice and did that instead. Yeah. And it's heaven. Nobody next to or behind me. I had space to sit back, to move, and generally enjoy the movie. This week, for Wall Street 2, which I liked mostly because I'll go and see Michael Douglas in just about anything, and Gordon Gekko is one of my favourite film characters, I thought it was a fine return, says Julian in brackets. I just went straight for the same aisle seat, and it was just as amazing.
There we go.
Why did I not think of this sooner? Finally, I can look forward to my weekly cinema visit, and I don't have to worry about it being ruined. Now I've got a renewed passion just for the act of going to see the movies again. How about that?
Coda to that is somebody asked me why it is that I always sit on the left-hand side of the cinema, and the reason is simple: that when I was a child and I used to go to the cinema, and you remember this, not because we knew each other as children, but you were a child in about the same period that I was. It used to be that the left-hand side of the cinema was the no-smoking side of
the
cinema,
which was, that made a huge difference.
Exactly, it was like having a no-weeing lane in the swimming pool. It didn't really make any difference. You ended up in the middle of it anyway. But in theory, the left-hand side of the cinema was the no-smoking aisle. So that was why I always gravitated towards left, and it has to be an aisle, obviously.
Apparently, the latest candidates for Nobel Prizes at Manchester University are Dan Mufasa King and Sam Hobnob Taylor Woods.
Oh, really?
That's the latest. They're just in touch.
Sam Taylor Woods.
Well, no, it's not that Sam Taylor Woods. It's Sam Hobnob Taylor Woods.
Oh, I thought that was a nick. There's somebody... I'm sorry about, you know... It's like, you know, Simon Wow Wow.
Hazel.
Mayo.
This is Hazel now in, I think it's Lilongwe in Malawi. I was happy to hear Simon... I was happy to hear Mark's reaction to people sitting behind him in the cinema, kicking his chair, on your Newcastle special on the 17th of September. I live in Lilongwe in Malawi, and there is no cinema... at all. Okay. Although, thankfully, there are BBC podcasts which allow me to live cinema vicariously. I manage to physically visit the cinema about two or three times a year when I'm on holiday. And therefore, these visits are a treasured indulgence which I look forward to for months. However, after the excitement of choosing the film and settling down in my chair, I start to be filled with anxiety. I look round and start wondering which of the people in the vicinity is going to start doing something to ruin my experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The kicking of the chair is high on the list of crimes, along with talking during the previews, or sitting in front of me texting during the film and therefore shining mobile phone lights into my eyes.
Yep.
If any of these events occur, I feel a rage erupting inside me and I want to climb over a chair and start beating the culprit.
Well, I suggested an armed response, didn't I? That's what we need.
I then start feeling bad about myself, thinking it's wrong to feel such anger over such silly things. Therefore, it was extremely comforting to hear Mark's rant. I'm going to be in London next week and hope to see a couple of movies. As I settle down, I think I will start feeling smug instead of anxious, knowing that I have similar reactions to such a famous film critic. Now, there's lots of etiquette stuff coming in.
Yes.
From people whose experience has been ruined by people doing the aforementioned texting, tweeting,
kicking,
talking, eating with mouthful, and so on. So you remember when you went to the cinema, went to the swimming pool when you were a kid, and there were posters on the wall that said,
no running, no jumping, no petting.
All that.
Yeah. The no petting picture was always the best because it was a cartoon of two people with their arms around each other and sort of love hearts coming out from between.
What are the chances do you think that we would get cinemas to sign up to a code of conduct? We could. Why don't we put a certificate on our website? We'll get round to this.
Right, you're making this up as you go along. Go on.
Well, what I think we should do is come up with the equivalent of no smoking, no petting, no running, and all that kind of stuff.
No bombing, no ducking, no diving.
Clearly.
No swimming in the diving area. That was the other one. Sorry.
We've moved on from that. This is now for the cinema.
No, but it's just that you started me remembering it. It's like, you know, there's nine things, isn't it?
If you go, the only thing of your favourites, which I don't think we can fairly include, is the thing about having no one in front of you, behind you, left or right, because clearly that is asking too much of a cinema.
Yes.
But I think we could ask the patrons of the cinema to sign up to a code of conduct. What do you think?
Do you mean the people going to the cinema sign up to it, or the cinemas sign up to having a sign which says no petting, no diving, no running, no jumping?
I think it should be a code of conduct which moviegoers could sign up to.
Moviegoers could sign up?
We've already established that you're a pedant without merit.
Without portfolio. I'm a pedant without portfolio.
Without merit.
Yeah, okay.
So I think cinemas can sign up to it, and individuals can sign up to it, and it can be proudly displayed, you know?
Yeah.
A bit like, you know,
I'm for it.
Salesman of the month.
Yeah, kind of thing. Okay. Very good. So the way to do it would be, if you could get enough people to sign up to it individually, they could then go to their local cinema and get the cinema to sign up to
it. So establish the first three, and then what we'll do is we'll then compile a list and we'll put them all online, and it'll be a cut out and keep certificate.
Well, we have cartoons of people doing the thing.
I think we probably should.
So basically, it'll be based on the old swimming thing.
You can only do three, okay? Let's start off the first three rules for polite, respectful cinema attendance in future will be. Give us the first three.
No kicking, no talking, no texting.
Right, no kicking of the chair.
Yeah.
So I promise. How can cinema promise not? Okay. Okay.
No. I tell you, and it's not just kicking. It's the thing when your leg is in contact with the seat in front, which means that any movement of yours is transmitted not only through the chair, but through the chair of the five people in chairs bolted onto that same chair.
So what it should say is quite clearly: in this screen, there will be zero tolerance of kicking of chairs, texting.
Talking. Yes.
Fine. They're the first three. What should we... We're going to get a lot. It could be like 100.
But how many are we going to whittle it down to?
Well, let's see what comes in.
Okay.
If they're the only three, then it'll be three.
And is it going to have a name, like the Wittertainment Code of Conduct?
Well, that's clearly where it is at the moment.
Okay,
I think. So it's mayo@bbc.co.uk, 85058 on the text, if you'd like to add something which is your particular bête noire of movie attendance.
Oh, I thought of another one. No Michael Bay.
You're only let... No. That's a stupid thing. That's ridiculous. This is something for which you have personal responsibility. You can't then say, oh, and no 3D.
Did you see the fantastic news story that they started filming Transformers 3 and the police attempted to stop them by ramming one of the trucks?
Yes, in fact, our correspondent in Washington has... You remember he was concerned last week that he wasn't able to get his wife to the hospital in time.
Because of Transformers 3.
Yeah, there's no baby yet.
Okay.
That's an update on that. Is it David Arnold time yet?
Is he here?
It is David Arnold time.
Any time is David Arnold time.
Okay, so we will take your suggestions for the new Wittertainment Code of Conduct, to which you will be expected to sign up to. Michael, on this email, dear Fowler's Modern and English Usage, as someone who spent too much time working as a proofreader and used to judge the quality of a restaurant by the number of spelling mistakes in the menu, I regard myself as a pedant of the most irritating kind. However, I felt obliged to weigh in on the prepositions at the end of a sentence debate, which you have just been poking around in. The idiocy of this convention was first pointed out to me by a French teacher, quoting Winston Churchill's satirical debunking of the rule, "This is something up with which I will not put." May I quote Marcus Aurelius on the subject of correcting others?
Go for it.
From Alexander the Grammarian: to refrain from fault-finding, and not in reproachful way to chide those who uttered any barbarous or solecistic or any strange-sounding expression, but dexterously to introduce the very expression which ought to have been used, and in the way of answer or giving confirmation or joining in an inquiry about the thing itself, not about the word or by some other fit suggestion. I've got no idea what it means, but I thought quoting Marcus Aurelius would be a first. for the network.
That's very good. You sounded fantastically pompous doing that.
Yeah. Well, if you quote Marcus Aurelius, I think that
kind of goes with the territory.
That's the only one. So 85058 mayo@bbc.co.uk for the code of conduct. We have some guests who I think first of all should contribute a couple of lines for our code of conduct. Do you want to introduce them, Mark?
Yes. Well,
this is contributor here,
David, and this is Tommy, David Arnold. David Arnold, you were on the show very recently, weren't you, David?
Yeah. Very blessed to be back.
Thank Hello,
very
David.
Much for having us.
Internationally renowned composer, known best for movies, and brought here with an instrument which he is going to demonstrate some of his fantastic musical skills.
It'll teach you to start talking to Mark at parties.
I'm still not sure whether this is a good idea.
Oh, it is a good idea.
You were blindingly drunk at the time, Mark.
Yes, so, but still blindingly able to tell a good voice when I heard one. And this is Tommy.
Yes, and hello, Tommy.
Hello, Simon.
Why aren't you going to sing? Why are you here anyway?
Well, I'm here because I produce the concert we'll probably talk about at some point.
Oh, I don't think we'll ever get round to that.
Well, should we do that at the beginning?
We'll run out of time.
Let's do that together. So the concert for Care, which because it's important.
Let's get it out
because
the way.
You guys were on the programme when we were absent, talking about it before. Concert for Care on Monday. Give us a few...
Monday the 18th of this month.
It's October.
October, that's it.
It's Monday, in fact.
Yeah.
That's why when I said Monday, I didn't feel it needed any further.
It's on Monday. It's next Monday. It's been a long month. It's been a long year. It's a film music concert for people who like film music and films. So here we are. If you're in that combination of liking film music and comedy and concerts, then you're in the right place. So it's basically a lot of my friends who are film composers. We're getting together and we are performing music from the films that we like that we've written for. So I'm doing stuff from Casino Royale and Independence Day, for instance. Dario Marinelli's doing Atonement. Michael Nyman's going to come and play the piano, on the piano.
What a shock.
It would have been great if you'd done it on the banjo,
just to be irritating.
Well. And there's so many people. Harry Gregson Williams coming over from LA to do Narnia with Imogen Heap, who's going to sing. Paloma Faith's going to sing. How to Train Your Dragon, John Powell, Chicken Run. So many people, it's unbelievable.
Matt Lucas and Alfie Bowe.
Me and Ricky Wilson from the Kaiser Chiefs doing a duet.
Fantastic.
So a little bit of everything for loads of people.
And it's an aid of Care International.
It is.
Care International, tickets still available. Starts at around about 7, with, of course, our very surprise and extra special warm-up band, who everyone is absolutely looking forward to.
We managed to find the only nationally loaned skiffle band with a national
broadcast. With a cinema connection.
Not them again. They get everywhere.
They'll be in the hall at 7 o'clock, so if you're coming,
stay in the bar.
Exactly, yes.
Then when the whole thing starts piling.
Does your cinema lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight? And other assorted songs with a washboard and double bass.
We are establishing a code of conduct for cinema goers, for cinemas to promote, and then if you go to the cinema, you have to sign up before you're allowed into various screens. We've established that the first three are...
No kicking, no talking, no texting?
Because this is clearly a very irritating thing. I'm going to ask you to contribute something else for our code of conduct. Various ones coming in. No hats.
Yeah.
You would imagine that might have been a problem sort of many years ago, but very few people keep
Nicky Lauder wouldn't have liked that one.
No. Bad ice dead fods as well.
No nachos with cheese and all snacks to be consumed by the end of the trailers. That's quite a good one, actually.
If you're with nachos with cheese.
Definitely.
Get rid of them before the trailers.
I think there's a challenge for Doritos to come up with a silent nacho.
It's not the nacho, it's the packet more than anything, isn't it?
Silent packet, then.
Yeah, silent. If somebody could invent the silent... So you don't get
it's effectively a pillowcase.
I went to a...
There we go. You know, snacks in pillowcases would work.
I went to a screening once where the girl sat not in the seat next to me, but the one next to that, with put the nachos, balanced them on the arm of the chair there, right next to my coat, which is on the thing, which is quite expensive. And I told her, please be careful, I don't want the cheese sauce going on my coat. And then halfway through the film, because I was presenting a breakfast show at the time, and it was night, I fell asleep. And when I woke up, I kicked...
What was the film?
It was the Tom Hanks movie with... where he's
Could you
he's
narrow
Charlie
down
Wilson's
no, no, Saving Private Ryan.
No, it wasn't Saving Private Ryan.
So you fell asleep in Saving Private Ryan.
He was a hitman. He was a hitman in the 20s.
Oh, based on the Road to Perdition.
Road to Perdition, thank you.
Can I just acknowledge that I got that before
you got it in your ear. Somebody said it in the control room.
Nobody did.
Yes, they did.
No, they didn't turn around.
But I kicked them 2 feet in the air anyway, and of course they went over everybody.
Well, that was your fault.
And you had to go and explain that.
Don't fall asleep.
So, you had to explain to your girlfriend what those cheese stains were.
Yeah, exactly.
None of us have got a chance of heaven. Oh, my.
Well, I think marshmallows in pillowcases are the answer to the snack problem.
Next.
I did have a particular one, actually. It came from an experience when I was working on a film in Los Angeles, and I went to see a film in one of these little sort of towns. We're like on the outskirts of LA, and they were showing Arachnophobia. And it was one of those movie theaters where you buy a ticket. I think this happens quite a lot in America. You buy a ticket, and then people just wander in and out of cinemas regardless. You know, they check your ticket at the door. You go and see the start of Arachnophobia, decide you don't like it, so you wander into something else. In there. So people constantly wandering in and out. But something which has stuck with me an awful long time, I thought we should ban, is someone had a pretend spider on a stick, which they held up in front of the projector. So every now and then, when the big spider turned up in Arachnophobia, someone would stick it up so there'd be a big shadow of it.
Can I be honest with you? Spiders on sticks. Be honest with you. It's a problem that's going to arise in a limited way. It's like no water
in the middle
pistols.
Of Eat, Pray, Love. It might be quite a welcome distraction.
Well, Eat, Pray, Love, spider. I mean, actually, that would work.
What about if they had the concession stand?
Anyway, listen, can I just point out, right, look, you're here to sing a song, promote a gig, and then you can go. So, because what's going to happen is we're waiting for this Liverpool announcement, right? And
runs
halfway through the song,
starts with song.
There'll be a guy who comes out of the offices of Slaughter and May in Central London to announce what's happened at Liverpool, and you'll have to stop the song.
Okay, so let me tee this up. So basically, we were at this party. It was later than we wandered over to the piano, and David sat down, and everyone was going, go on, David, play us a bit of a Bond thing, play us a bit of a thing. And David started playing, and then, as if from nowhere, came this voice.
The bowels of hell.
You're building this up terribly, Mark. I mean,
I'm sorry, he said, I've never done it in
public. A nation of very disappointed people in a minute who are going to be going,
what are you going to play for us?
Well, I don't know, because, hey, I can't hear this.
Oh, you can't hear them? Put your headphones on. You can't hear them through your neck.
My headphones on. There's nothing coming through my headphones.
I have these ones. Let's
see what's through there. Oh, is it?
Headphones with nothing on.
You know, while he's messing around with that, can I just tell us about
Care International?
No, I want to tell you about because, you know, Hitchcock didn't want people to come into the cinema after this film had started. That was another convention he wanted to introduce, wasn't it, for Psycho. We're showing Psycho as part of the events on Sunday morning at 9:30 at the Empire Leicester Square, thanks to Dave Norris, who is the chief projectionist there, who's one of those people that Mark often talks about is a dying breed.
Yes.
And Dave Norris is one of the absolute best in the business, I think, and he's got us this film. So we're showing Psycho at 9:30 in the morning at the Empire Leicester Square. We'd love lots of people to come to see that too, because all the money for that goes to Care.
If you're late, you won't get in.
No, you'll come in at any time you like.
In the case of Psycho, because famously there were cardboard cutouts, full-size cardboard cutouts of Hitchcock standing in the foyer, pointing at his watch to explain to people that they had to go in, and if they didn't go in, they weren't going to be allowed in. And he made a really big deal of it. They would actually lock the door so you couldn't go in.
Look, Rachel Hodges is in to read the news, and we haven't even got to the song yet. Can you hear anything yet?
Yeah, I've got it. This is all bluffing tactics. I'm hoping Liverpool make an announcement.
No, there's no announcement yet. Are you going to sing a James Bond hit?
Well, no, I'm not. Well, Mark asked me to sing something that I sang on the night because it was a song that actually...
Well, he won't remember. He was so drunk.
Do you want to do the news, really?
No. Off you go.
Seriously? Okay, this was actually one that Scott Walker ended up recording. It's called Only Myself to Blame. I wrote it for the end titles of The World Is Not Enough. But we didn't use it in the end because it was what we call in the business a wrist slasher.
Right, so it was rejected because it was too depressing?
Yes, you could put it like that. Yeah.
Perfectly placed for this programme.
Yeah. So seriously, you want to go?
If I start waving at you, we've got a Liverpool statement.
I've walked way past midnight. I've driven for days. I've tried to forget in so many ways. I shouldn't look back, but I do just the same. And I've only myself to blame. From city to city, I still see your face. It follows me round all over the place. I shouldn't look back, but I do just the same. And
have only myself to blame. I knew it was love, but when you are young, you think love will come again and again. There's no greater fool. Fool's Hall of Fame, and I've only myself to blame. I knew it was love, but when you are young, you think love will come again and again. There's no greater fool in the Fool's Hall of Fame, and I've only myself, only myself, only myself to blame.
I'm so terribly sorry, everyone.
Yeah, it is. It's a bit of a wrist slasher. You wouldn't want that at the end of a Bond film.
Oh, that was so much better than what we had.
That was fantastic, David. Thank you very much. How did that feel for you?
It's shocking.
Have you ever sung in public before?
Not all that often. Certainly not lately. The thing is, that's the sort of thing I would send off to the people for. You know, here's a demo,
like a guided vocal.
This is kind of what it sounds like. So, I mean, it was extraordinary actually, because Scott Walker was standing there, Don Black, the lyric writer, was standing there, and we just played the song through, and then Scott recorded it, and that's an event in its own, which was beautiful.
Even though it didn't make it into the picture,
it didn't. It was on the soundtrack album, but you know, I think it was my second Bond movie. And, you know, it felt like we've had quite a lot of kind of up sort of jazzy electronic stuff, and I thought we'll.
Do you think you'll have another Bond movie?
Yeah, hopefully. Just waiting for the MGM situation to level itself out a little bit, but everyone's raring to go.
Where are we with that?
You know? We're waiting for whatever corporate entities need to do their corporate nonsense in Los Angeles, and then hopefully we'll be off.
So why are you gesturing? I'm just basking.
I
in the
want to say something
because I'm basking in the wonderful afterglow of that song. Isn't it lovely?
It's very good. Tommy, final word on Care International. What if people want to come along to this concert? Presumably there are tickets still available, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Well, that's a good point. There are tickets still available, everything from £10 upwards, so it's a good deal. The concert itself is on Monday, 7:30, Level Hall. The screening for Psycho, if you want to go to that, is 9:30 Sunday morning at the Empire Leicester Square. Just come along to that. That would be great fun too. Just go to the website, www.concertforcare.com.
And a whole bunch of the composers from the gig are going to be at the Empire Leicester Square. We're going to have a little Q&A and signing thing afterwards. So,
and Bernard Herrmann's widow, Norma, is going to introduce the screening on Sunday morning, so that's pretty special.
Excellent. Tommy, thanks very much indeed. It goes very well. David, appreciate you coming in.
And we
enjoyed your musical debut on this show.
Perhaps we'll have something a bit cheerier next time. That could be a regular thing.
Yeah, do the theme from that most recent Bond film that sounded like Knees Up Mother Brown.
I didn't write that.
No, I
think we have a new feature.
I know you didn't.
We have a new feature called You Think That Was Depressing. You wait till you hear them. Anyway, David Arnold, Tommy Pearson, thanks very much indeed. Is Anton Corbin going to be with us next?
Why are you looking at me? I'm in the same studio as you are. I have the same information available to me that you do. Look at the people in the control room.
It was a rhetorical question. I knew what the answer was. You can get involved. Lots and lots of contributions for our new code of conduct, which is it's got some really, really good stuff.
Including no spiders on sticks.
No, this is great because this will be something that all people who work in cinemas will be able to test. Sean Mallion in Bristol, to add to your list of code of conduct. No eating of any food that is louder to eat than a soft white roll with no filling. That is the test. If it's noisier than that, you can't come in. And we're delighted to say Anton Corbin is here as well. Very good to see you, Anton. Thanks very much. Do you have a choice of microphones? Do you want orange or blue?
Well, obviously, as a Dutchman, I will go for the orange one.
Of course.
Thank you.
Nicely placed.
Very good. It was very well done.
We're trying to establish, before we talk about your movie, and we're establishing a code of conduct for people going to the cinema, because this programme is full of people who complain about people eating, kicking the back of their chair when they don't want people talking, all that kind of stuff. So there's just lots of correspondence about the rules that people should sign up to, really, if they're going to go and be a proper cinema goer.
Right.
Barry from Bristol, you see a lot of people saying things like this, Mark. No laughing at things which aren't funny.
Regularly very hard to police.
Well, I don't know. I think it's worth pointing out that if you laugh at the wrong place, you haven't got the film.
No, because there are films that I have laughed at because they are rubbish.
Okay,
so you can't have that. But thank you for the suggestion, but no.
Graham in Runcorn, I can handle people eating, but can I suggest no wrapped confectionery?
Yeah, that comes under the marshmallows in a pillowcase or no food.
That's noisier than a soft bread roll with no filling.
Yeah.
James in Ealing, my 12-year-old son was at the cinema in Ealing a few years ago at a matinee, and the lady behind him was sick all over him. No recompense, no apology from anyone, no offer of a free ticket. So can we add no vomiting?
Yeah,
say no murders, it's not very helpful.
It's just a very extreme reaction to a film, I'd say.
Do you think?
Also, I quite like the idea of being in a film that makes someone vomit, or a film that... I mean, I've been in a film a couple of times when people have passed out, and it's been really exciting. And as I said, I mean, I saw screening of Exorcist when somebody passed out, screening of the Irreversible when somebody passed out. In fact, we did a screening at the Tate Britain of Andrzej Żuławski's film Possession, and somebody passed out in that. It had to be carried out of the auditorium, and it really made the film exciting. So I think bodily responses need to be allowed.
How about people ramming their seat backs into your knees or shins? I'm over 6 foot, says Pete, BSc Honours and MA. I was once crippled by a large lady repeatedly crushing my patella tendons.
You mean behind you?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that...
No, in front. I imagine she leant back.
Yes, that's what I mean. You're behind her. Yeah, I think you can't police the movement of the seat in front of you and hold on to the don't touch the seat in front of you rule. Sorry.
Here's a good one. Jack in Swansea. I propose adding a ban on asking your friend, who's already seen the film, what's going to happen next, or even worse, telling somebody what is going to happen. An insufferable sin.
I was at a screening of Evita, the Madonna film, in Southampton, when, as you know, in Evita, because it's all done in opera, everyone goes, I am going up the stairs because it is an opera. And the woman would turn to her and go, she's going up the stairs now. She's going up the stairs, yeah. I am now at the top of the stairs. She's at the top of the stairs now.
Roger Mainwood in Wivenhoe, no knee trembling. Nothing worse than having a vibrating leg next to you. It's impossible to ignore, however gripping the film is. I'm afraid I am a knee trembler.
You are a knee trembler.
But once it takes you, you've got to go with it.
Yeah. Well, my friend Nick Cooper used to review movies with his left leg.
For The Guardian?
No, with his left leg.
Not very exciting. Anton, is there anything that you'd like to add to our code of conduct?
Something people aren't allowed to do in a cinema.
Something people shouldn't be allowed to do whilst watching The American, for example, your current film.
Well, the only problem I have in cinemas is really the distance between chairs, because I'm quite tall. So I think every chair should be a corner chair.
Every chair is an aisle chair. But there are some cinemas in which that's almost the case. Like, for example, if you go to the Electric in Notting Hill, the seats are almost all the individual armchairs, in which it's virtually impossible to get... It's all like sitting in first class in an aeroplane. Or the Screen 7 down in Redruth in Cornwall. It's a similar thing. And in fact, that may well be the answer, is more seat space and individually sprung seats,
and that means less money for the cinema, and it'll never happen. And at this point,
I think you charge more money generally, but you have more comfort.
Yes,
see, that's quite a good idea.
I'd pay more for more comfort.
Now Anton is thinking, I didn't come here to discuss bad behaviour in cinema. He's got a film to promote, and that film is The American, starring George Clooney. So it's good to have you here, Anton. Tell us about The American and who he is and what he's up to.
Well, The American is an adaptation from an English novel called A Very Private Gentleman. But because of my wanting to change everything from my first film, Control, to this film, I changed the character from an Englishman to an American. And that has become the title in the end. The American is a gunsmith who escapes after a very bad thing he does in the beginning of the film, to a little place in Italy to basically hide away a bit and sort himself out. And it's really about the journey the guy makes the inner journey to change his life and to turn his life around. Yeah, so I'll leave it at that for now.
Why couldn't he have been an Englishman?
Because I really wanted to work with non-English actors. I wanted to change everything from my first film to this film. And that included the nationality of the actors.
You'd had enough of the English actors in control.
No, I think they were fantastic. It was possibly the best experience in my life, really, making that film, I have to say. But, you know, I'm a beginner at this whole thing, making films, and I wanted to get a lot of experience. If I want to be a proper director, I have to have a lot of various experiences. And changing the nationality of the actors was one of them. I mean, there's many differences between the two films, but... that meant that the main character couldn't be English anymore.
George Clooney is notoriously—he's a great guy. He's had him on the program. He always seems the most engaging, a wonderful actor. Has many fans, but he's also quite—he chooses his directors very carefully. What did you say to him to win him? Because I think he's also got a production credit on this as well. How did you get him involved with this?
Well, you know, because
if he's a fan of your work, it must be Control, that being the only film you've done.
True.
Well, he may well have seen, you know, you've done loads of pop videos, and obviously you're known originally as a rock photographer, so you thought that you don't have a huge portfolio of work that he would know. It's not like Anton arrived at, you know, ex nihilo with Control.
There must have been something in Control.
No, he really loved the David Sylvia video in 1984.
He's a big Depeche Mode fan, and he just couldn't get enough. Do you see how I did that? Yeah, well done, thank you.
Very, very good, yeah. No, you know, I guess for an actor, the first thing is always the script. So he liked the script, the story, and he liked Control indeed very much. And I guess, you know, as an actor, he chooses his roles carefully, and this was probably a part he wanted to play, and it's the darkest part he's ever played, I think, and maybe that was attractive to him.
Because he is, you know, on screen, one of the most likeable actors in the world. I mean, he just has that persona, but the character that he's playing here is anything but.
Yeah, you couldn't help noticing that, yeah. No, it's
you mean
that
the casual slaying of a woman at the beginning of the film in the snow was a bit of a giveaway that perhaps
Hang on,
this wasn't
George Clooney.
Yes, that's, yeah. Although of course he has played dark. I mean, you look at something like Michael Clayton, and there are many parts in which he's
there are elements of Michael Clayton which I really liked for this role, the darkness, the angriness. And I told him that these elements I really like, and we need to put that into a whole character. And I mean, the strength from George, of course, is that. You know, he's such a versatile and great actor that you stay with him in this film, where very little is said, and he can do a lot with very little. I mean, the whole, you know, body language is great with him, and that's also why the pacing of the film is quite slow, because you need to observe him, and I always like that anyway, actually, that you observe people in a film rather than you being told what to watch.
Did he take direction?
Yes, when I said left, he would go to the right. I mean, it's very good.
I was just struck by the beginning of our conversation. You said, you know, you're a beginner. This is your second film. Clooney clearly has done scores and scores, maybe hundreds of pictures. He kind of knows. Was there any part of you that thought, hang on, he probably knows what he's doing more than I know what I'm doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, his experience is unbeatable, and he has been associated with films in many different roles, and not just as an actor. And that was, of course, great for me to fall back on his expertise if I needed it. But I go from intuitive kind of vibe, and that worked usually very well. The first day on the film, I was very aware that I was having a main actor who had directed already more films than I had. But I looked around me, and then everybody on the set had more experience than I had, so I just left it at that. You know, I wasn't too impressed in the end with... having very little experience myself.
You said the two things which seem to me to be obvious touchstones is there's Melville's a samurai, and there's a sort of an air of Antonioni about the film as well. So that idea, that kind of the existential hero, it's not to do with what's said, it's to do with the look, it's to do with the isolation, seemed to me very much to chime in with samurai. Was that intentional? You pulled the weirdest face when I said that, as if I'm not allowed to say that.
No, you are, and it's been mentioned many times, but I've never seen the film.
You must have seen The Samurai.
No, I've never seen The Samurai. I've seen Antonioni films.
Yeah.
I've seen, you know, I've never seen that many films. I don't come from that angle, you know, of being a film buff. I was trying to find a language within film. Photography has not been different for me. I didn't know anything about photography when I started to make pictures. And the way you say, yeah, I'm sure, is probably because you think they're crap. But
I don't think they come at all.
There you go. We invite guests on and then you tell them what they believe and what they don't.
This is a Dutch joke. It's an orange
microphone. This is a Dutch humour.
Yeah. Well, look, Anton, I apologise for my friend here who does have this habit of correcting people on what they have seen and what they haven't seen. What they should see.
As Anton said quite clearly, I think most people who were, you know, would see an element of the same year. I'm surprised to hear that you haven't. That's perfectly fine.
Well, most journalists mentioned it, so I know. Fine. I'm sure there is a similarity somewhere, and I would accept that. But it's not. It doesn't come from me. If there's any resemblance.
And into our code of conduct, possibly, though this is down to Mark. Al on the M62, I'd like to ban my mum from asking me who the characters in films are.
Yeah.
David in Bromley.
I'll tell you what, though, if you did that with Anton's film, if you went, who's that? He'd explain it. Who's that? That's it. It's those two. And then it'd be a very long time for you had to explain who anybody else was.
David in Bromley, a woman sitting behind me got out her balls of wool and needles and started knitting. Once the click-click noise began, I told her to shut up. I think no knitting is you need to be explained. I think everyone knows you shouldn't knit.
You can knit quietly.
You can't be a nitpicker all your life.
Very good. Another Dutch joke. And it's wall-to-wall gags.
Exactly. What is Dutch humour like? I don't mean an example, but I mean, is it very dry and very impenetrable?
It wants to be up there with the English, yeah.
What are the great Dutch comedy movies?
Oh, I don't know about comedy movies in Holland. I'm not in touch with Dutch...
We need
cinema
to do this before you go.
Years.
Can yeah. We need an email,
some
please,
great
or a text.
Comedians there, but movies, I don't know.
What is the funniest Dutch film? 850-58-mayo@bbc.co.uk. The hilarious moments in Dutch cinema which need to be...
There must have been a moment when Paul Verhoeven made a comedy, even though he didn't know. Showgirls, I can think that will count as the greatest Dutch comedy.
On the subject of your film, George, I kind of think it was interesting because the love scenes in the film are quite graphic, by which I mean for a George Clooney film... They're quite graphic, and it's almost as though if George is in a movie and there's a love scene, it's sort of restrained and it's held back and it's soft-focused. But this is pretty graphic for George. Is that fair comment?
It's fair comment. You know, it's part of my Dutch character came out, I guess, there. But
what does that mean?
We grow up with full frontal nudity in Holland, you know, in the films in the 70s. And still, I went to a Dutch film last week, and there's three scenes on the toilet, you know, and that's just an average film. It drives me crazy.
Who wants to watch three scenes on the toilet?
Well, I don't, for starters. But
what was the film?
What was the film called?
Terza.
Terza, okay. Mr. Poopy goes to the toilet.
No, it has nothing.
What does Terza mean?
It's just the name of a girl, but in the film.
You don't want to encourage that.
No, I don't, but
The
frontal nudity, it is quite common in Holland, and so for me it fell into the European tradition of filmmaking, and I think that sex scene you're referring to is done in a very restrained way, but therefore very exciting, I think.
But my point is not restrained for a George Clooney movie.
No, the way it's filmed, I mean, is restrained. Mm. You know, the effect is not restrained, but the way we filmed it. Tasteful is an awful word, so I won't use that.
I think the most significant thing about the visuals, I'm a huge fan of control, and your photography, I'm a very big fan of it. I think the most interesting thing about it is in the end, for me, and feel free to shoot me down in flames in the same way as you did about Le Samurai, it's a film about landscapes, but as much the landscape of the characters' faces as anything else. I mean, one of the interesting things, it's a film which spends a lot of time looking at the land and looking at the face of George Clooney. And because for a film which there aren't very many words in, it's not a wordy film. There are certain sort of speeches, particularly in connection with the priest. Sure. But it's actually an awful lot of it is to do with looking at the geography of his face and looking at tiny movements in his face. It's a film of stillness. And one of the central themes of it is he's a craftsman and he's making something during the course of the movie. And it's a film in which you can watch a very intricate little process of craftsmanship and become interested in the landscape of that process. I wonder whether that...
Well, all these things emphasise the loneliness, and it's like the isolation he's put into. And then his love, the only love in his life is really making these guns, and all the dedication goes into that. But again, it emphasises the loneliness, and then you understand the change he's going through.
There's a central discussion in the film, which is a conversation between his character, as you said, he's a hitman, and
well, he's a gunsmith.
He's really a gunsmith, yeah. And a priest. And the priest, during the course of the movie, talks to him about, you know, about his soul and about the fact that he's a man lost, and there are occasions when a priest is brought. And they're very kind of, you know, existential discussions, but also theological discussions. I wonder where you stand in relation to that, because the Clooney character keeps saying, I don't believe in any of this, I don't need any of this. But the indication during the drama is that actually he does. Actually, during the course of it, he does discover that there is something beyond his own isolation.
True, and the last thing the priest says to him is, what have you got? Like, it's totally empty life. You know, I come from a very religious upbringing, so that felt good to me. Also, the element of a Western where the morality is always very simple, it's good or bad. There's a lot of Western elements in the film, and that's one of them. You know, this stranger does something, then hides into a town. We don't know any background to him. In that town, he connects to the priest and the prostitute, the spiritual and the physical. And then the past catches up with him, there's a shootout, and leaves town again. That's the basic framework of a Western, and I've used that in this
one. And also, it's quite confusing. You talk about a straightforward morality, but also I found watching the film, looking at the gun as a thing of beauty.
Exactly, and that's why I understand why he can dedicate his life to that. Although a gun itself, I'm a pacifist, so it doesn't come from a love of the gun, but the love of making a gun, that's his occupation.
We have 60 seconds left. I just want to ask you one thing without giving anything away about the ending. Was it discussed, the ending? You know, did George chip in with a, can we do it like this?
Actually, yes. And it's a different ending than the book, I can't reveal.
I was disappointed that they all break out into song and dance routine.
Yeah.
I think that was not quite in keeping.
I heard that was quite popular. And we want to get the American malls involved.
It was when Depeche Mode came on. I thought it was.
And Bono walks on and goes,
Bono walked on, exactly, and that was.
But the Joshua Tree.
He did feed the world, feed the children.
I think we lost it at that point.
Herbert Grönemeyer, I'd like to say. Thank you.
Anton, it's been great having you on the program. What do you work on next? Do you know? Can you tell us?
I'm working on another film, and I've. With my photography openings in the next 2 weeks in Frankfurt and New York.
And I think you've got a book of photographs based on the
book also,
called the snaps that you took during the, I can't inside call them Corbin snaps, but
well, they are snaps. Inside the American is called.
You know what you should work on? You should work on going down to a cinema and seeing Melville's The Samurai and standing up in the middle of it and going, hang about, I've done this!
But the American one, imagine, it's a 15 certificate, I imagine, in this country, is it?
Yes,
you
got me there.
It's got buttocks and front buttocks, so
it must
one
be 12,
imagines that
12,
it,
probably.
It's not going to be a 12, mate. Let me tell you.
In Holland,
in Holland, it's a U. Everyone, gather.
Come
the
home to Holland, guys.
Orangey boom, yeah.
Anton Corbin, thanks very much indeed.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Mr. Poopy goes to the toilet.
Look, he said, the last film I saw had 3 toilet scenes in it.
To which you said, Mr. Poopy goes to the toilet.
It's Dutch. It's Dutch humour.
If Mr. Poopy goes to the toilet was directed by Anton Corbin, it would probably be quite a tasteful film, don't you think?
Do you know...
But why is it that the Dutch have to have front buttocks and everything?
I don't know.
What is that?
Do you know, in television, do you know what a Dutch angle is?
I don't know.
It's if you have a camera angle that's on the squiff, it's like turned sideways.
Get those hands.
Okay, if you have a camera angle and it's on the squiff, turned sideways... It's called a Dutch angle because in Holland, everything's flat. So it's like Little John because he's not.
Very good.
I shall call you Little John because you are so big.
We are building
a Dutch angle because it is so flat.
Very good. I worked that one out. So code of conduct is what we're constructing. We're going to put this... won't be there for a while because I think we're going to... 10 rules is going to be... it was good enough for Moses. We should stick to that. So the Wittertainment Code of Conduct, which is going to be this for cinemas and for people who go to cinemas to try and observe, if at all possible... this has been provoked by a whole bunch of people complaining about seats being kicked, people talking, and all that kind of stuff. No translating, says David Ivory. I once saw Goldmember where one girl seated a few seats away from me translated into Spanish the entire film for her friend.
Well, that is a service. It's called simultaneous translation. And sometimes if you get a film that's not subtitled, you'll have a simultaneous translator. That's incidentally how Mark Cousins ran those films for the first movie.
No tutting when a tall person sits in front of you because he has no other option but to sit there and be tall. Mike, age 44, 6'8". from Ringworthy in Cornwall.
No tall people any further forward than the back three rows in that case.
There should be tall seats then and short seats, shouldn't there?
Yeah, but if you're in an aisle, you see, then it's always less of a problem because you can actually angle yourself around the person.
Simon, in relation to your list of cinema do's and don'ts, how about a ban on the person sitting next to you fidgeting impatiently because you aren't responding to the film in the way he thinks you should be? Could read, no exasperated gasping at the other spectators. Thank you. Linda Ruth Williams, Professor of Film, English Department, University of Southampton, BA Honours, First Class, MA Distinction, PhD, Sussex, and married to Mark.
Thanks for that. What was it?
No fidgeting impatiently because you aren't responding to the film in the way he thinks you should be. See, because people, that is, you think, I'm really enjoying this, or I'm really having a horrible time. The person I have brought to the cinema is clearly thinking something totally the opposite, and it spoils it for you.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. It's true, I do it, but sometimes I actually sit away from Linda in order to not do that. You know, as with the breaking the waves incident.
Why aren't you behaving the way you're supposed to?
No, but I don't say it.
But clearly every single part of you is screaming it.
Well, apparently so, but there we go.
Just add to the list of crimes against cinema etiquette, says Ruth Duff. A pregnant lady currently in the throes of labour whilst listening to the programme. Thank you for the distractions from the pain. Which is so... Is it a TENS machine? I think it's a TENS machine. Yeah, so we're up there with a TENS machine. We're a distraction from physical pain.
We are offering a minute electric shock.
My husband and I went to see Buried last weekend. But I'm not sure I want to see that anyway.
Well, certainly not in the advanced stages of pregnancy.
About 45 minutes into the movie, it had been well established that the entire dialogue of the movie was going to happen via a mobile phone. A fellow cinema goer not only received a phone call on their own mobile phone, but actually, to the disbelief of the rest of the audience, answered the call and had an extremely loud conversation, thus making it impossible to follow what Ryan Reynolds was saying into his mobile phone on the screen. The offender seemed totally oblivious to the disruption she was causing and quite rightly provoked many outbursts of expletives directed straight at her from various members of the audience, the most violent outburst coming from the man sitting directly behind me. I consider answering any mobile phone call in the cinema a hideous crime. This has to be the worst offence. I mean, I think that probably is, actually. That has to be the number one.
Yeah, I agree.
Did we go along with that?
Shocking.
Even worse than making the person next to you feel uncomfortable because they're not reacting in the appropriate way. Mm. Anyway, amongst the reviews in this hour will include what?
Social Network, Despicable Me, Over Your City's Grass Will Grow, and Vampire Suck. Shall we do the top 10?
Yes, we'll do that. Please continue to send in your etiquette guide. We'll work out the 10 essential items to include on the Wittertainment Code of Conduct, and then we can put it on the website and then you can cut it out. Well, obviously print it first, then cut it, because you can't use scissors into your computer.
On the interweb.
The UK Cinema Top 10.
Five Live.
At number 10, we have Toy Story 3.
As I've said before, better in 2D, and this will also come up in terms of Despicable Me.
Will it?
Yes, it will.
At number 9 is Buried, which we've kind of just...
Best scene in a cinema in which people are not receiving mobile phone calls.
This from Dr. Shane Grumpy Pants Sullivan.
Didn't he direct Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet?
I think we should probably cast that before we go.
It's going to end up in Benjamin Snidelgrass, I know, even as we're saying it.
So I was trying to think, could an entire movie shot inside a coffin keep people engaged for 90 minutes or more? The answer is a resounding yes. It was a claustrophobic tale of a man's descent into completing impotence and betrayal. A man abandoned, a man irritated by being kept on hold. A convincing central performance by Ryan Reynolds and a film which cleverly wrenched up the tension to a gut-wrenching finale. However, the most interesting part of the movie, here we go again, was that it revealed just how irritating it is to be stuck in a dark place, feeling impotent at the behaviour of others, being imposed on you against your will. The movie is often dark and demands attention, and to feel absorbed into the plight of Paul Conway. However, during the dark and quiet scenes, it was all too obvious that people were talking, eating noisily and laughing inappropriately. Indeed, the sense of irritation at being distracted by people checking their phones was quite profound. Is this a new trend in cinema? After 3D, we have 4D. The cinema hires actors to sit in the audience to provide the full cinema experience so that you feel you're in the movie.
Yeah, it is. It has to stop. The time has come to stop. We are going to make this code of conduct work.
Right, number 8, Eat, Pray, Love.
Vomit.
Well, we've already established that you can't do that.
No. Well, actually, no, I've established that you can. I've said that, bodily responses, you can't police them, you know.
Katie in Reading. I'm a new mum, and my postnatal group have recently started going to the cinema once a month. I wanted to kick off with Made in Dagenham, but went with the majority to see Eat, Pray, Love instead. Bombed. Unusually, I completely disagree with the good doctor's opinion. I felt that it held up the feminist cause and had a worthy and substantial message. That is, women should have the right to pursue happiness. Perhaps this seems frivolous or selfish compared to equal work for equal pay, but it's a message that I will pass on to my daughter.
I think what it proves is that women have the right to star in movies every bit as terrible as the movies that men star in. On that level, it is indeed a blow for equality.
So, Made in Dagenham at 7.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that this is one of the best movies around at the moment. I really like it. I've seen it more than once, as you know. I think the performances are great. I think it tells an important story, but I think it does so in a way that's entertaining. The difference between this and Eat, Pray, Love, Vomit is not just that this is an important story, it's that it's better told. It's more entertaining, more engaging, better written, certainly more disciplined, far less self-indulgent, and none of the kind of look at me on a spiritual journey nonsense that the Americans seem to love so much. I really think it's splendid. I want more people to go and see it. I believe that it's doing less well in the north of England than it is in the south of England, possibly because the word Dagenham is in the title. Who knows? But, you know, go see. It's a really great film.
The whole 3D at 6.
Which is performing remarkably well.
It's still in there.
Interesting, because it is one of those movies that's clearly problematic in terms of its demographic. When Joe Dante was on the programme, he was saying, you know, the studio kept saying, look, you make the kids older, you rack it up to a slightly higher certificate, you'll get a good, solid teen market out of it. But no, he kept it as a kids' horror movie, and it's done surprisingly well.
We have The Town at number 5.
Which is, I think, now being recognised for the rather more mediocre fare than it was the week that it got released. I mean, I was surprised at how much people were praising it when it first came out. I was certainly surprised at the level of the praise on the posters. It's a solid, but nothing more than that, cop thriller. That's what it is. It's a crime thriller. Actually, it's not a cop thriller. It's a criminal thriller with Ben Affleck acting a lot.
Sam Lana says, I recently saw The Town at the Genesis Cinema in Whitechapel. I saw it before listening to The Good Doctor's review. I was surprised at the praise that he gave the film.
No, I did. What?
I couldn't really get into it at all, and although I enjoyed the romantic moments between Affleck and Rebecca Hall, I was left feeling that the bank robbery scenes were fairly formulaic and perhaps even dull. However, my main point was to ask Mark if he noticed the Shawshank Redemption ending, which elicited a chuckle from me and my friend as we saw it.
Yes, well, there's some... it was somewhere. Was it in that? There's somewhere recently where somebody
somehow
was quoting the end. Maybe it was the Drew Barrymore film in which somebody was quoting the end of. No. It was in The Town.
This is slightly incoherent, Mark.
I think it was in The Town in which he's having the conversation with Rebecca, in which she says, "I think that's it." I may be confusing it with the Drew Barrymore movie because, as we know, my memory of movies is incredibly fluid. There's a film I've seen recently in which a woman says to a man that Shawshank is one of her favourite films, and he says, "I hope," and I think, "Yes, that's the."
We'll edit this bit out of the podcast.
Okay. Oh, no, we're doing it live.
The other guy's at 4.
Which, you know, Mark Wahlberg's the best thing about it. Will Ferrell is the worst thing about it. It's now finally dropping off after having not made a massive amount of money, but having made more than it should have done. But that's now what passes for good action buddy comedies.
At number 3, The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud.
See,
or, as Guy in New Zealand says, in Australia, New Zealand, it is just called Charlie St. Cloud.
Australia, New Zealand?
In Australia and New Zealand, yes.
How can he be in Australia and New Zealand?
In Australia and New Zealand, it is known as Charlie St. Cloud.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant the name of the guy, and he's in Australia and New Zealand. No, Charlie St. Cloud, The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud. Fine. I really like it. I mean, I'm a big fan of Zac Efron. I think he's an old-fashioned movie star. I think he's a proper physical actor. I think he moves and acts really well. This is much, much less mawkish than it could have been. Certainly, Burr Steers has done tougher work in the past, but this is for the target demographic, which is, you know, 12-year-olds and playing, I think, largely towards a young girl audience, because that's actually Zac Efron's, you know, big core audience. I think it's really solidly put together. I cried. I was moved. I like Zac very much. I'm pleased it's doing well.
Wall Street Money Never Sleeps is the box office number one.
No,
here.
You've jumped over.
I'm sorry, Life as We Know It. Sorry, number 2.
Yeah, it's rubbish.
Very good. Number 1, then, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
Yes.
David Anthony in Southampton. MA, Philosophy, Politics, Economics. Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, but I did. Having looked forward to this film for months, I found it incredibly tedious and was amazed at Oliver Stone's ability to turn the incredibly dramatic story of the collapse of many world banks into a dreary, overly complex bore fest. He managed to throw darkness instead of light on the murky world of complex finance and so create a dull sequel to a great original.
I think that all the time that Michael Douglas is on screen, it's an interesting film. I think all the time that Sleepy La Beef, Snoozy La Pork is on screen, it's a very uninteresting film. And it has lost its way, certainly. I still think there was 25 minutes of good stuff in it. It's just two hours of movie to deal with.
Bill Hodgson, dear Dr. Nice and Dr. Loud. So Dr. K's review is that Oliver Stone needed to shout louder.
Yeah.
In other shock news, The Exorcist is still good, 3D still bad, Big Hand still flappy. Now, look, it's 3:17 on the cusp of. What is our first movie for
Social
review?
Network.
The Social
Network. And you've
Network.
Seen Social Network as well, haven't you?
Do you know I have?
You have?
I have.
You have?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay. Did you see that Swedish vampire movie?
Yes, I've seen the Swedish vampire movie, the one that's been remade into English.
It has, or into American.
Would you like a heartwarming tale just before?
Before we go to Social Network, which is not like heartwarming, yeah.
No, I've got a heartwarming story. Yeah. Pat in Edinburgh. It's about projectionists. This is after our discussion at the Phoenix last week. He said, put me in mind of something which happened a couple of weeks ago that for me serves to demonstrate what makes local independent cinemas great and also why they need to be supported whenever possible. As I rushed from work to catch an early evening showing of the 1970s classic Five Easy Pieces at the Cameo Cinema in Edinburgh, it was clear that I was going to miss the magnificent first 5 or 10 minutes of the film, which I had grudgingly accepted. However, as I ran into the cinema, the projectionist popped over and asked if I would like the film to be restarted.
Really? Is it the only person in this?
I was the only person with a ticket. This simple act of kindness made my day and cemented my love for the place, a simple deed that would never be considered, let alone allowed, in the soulless mechanical monstrosity that is the modern-day multiplex. How about that?
Because now you'd have to ring Burbank and ask them to re-digitally send it from a satellite.
We have The Social Network to discuss.
So The Social Network, new film from David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin, who was on the programme last week. I mean, I'm assuming that everybody knows essentially what it's about. It's about the creation of Facebook, the question of whether or not Mark Zuckerberg did invent Facebook or not, and whether or not he did basically do over the person with whom he invented Facebook, and whether or not he actually ripped the idea off from the Winklevoss twins, referred to by Zuckerberg in the film rather terrifically as the Winklevi. It's an interesting film on a number of levels. I think the thing to say very clearly at the beginning is, and one of the things I like about it is, that it is essentially a film about the idea that a social networking revolution is created by somebody who has zero social skills. Aaron Sorkin himself said that the key thing for him about the script was that Zuckerberg was the perfect storm, in that he had the technical ability to create Facebook, but he also had the need to create a social networking computer site because of his own inabilities. And it's very clear at the beginning of the film that when we meet him at the opening scene, he's breaking up with his girlfriend, who tells him that he's a butt. And at the end of the film, somebody says to him, you know, you're not, you're just trying really hard to be. And you think, no, he really, really is. Anyway, what happens at the beginning, we see him breaking up with his girlfriend, and he then goes off and very spitefully takes to the internet. I think it's important that you understand this, because essentially the movie is not shying away from the fact that the birth of this idea is in something infantile, crass, chauvinistic, and basically revolting.
Erica Albright's a bitch. For the record, she may look like a 34C, but she's getting all kinds of help from our friends at Victoria's Secret. She's a 34B, as in barely anything there. False advertising. I need to do something to take my mind off her. Easy enough, except I need an idea. I'm a little intoxicated, I'm not gonna lie. So what if it's not even 10 p.m. and it's a Tuesday night? Really? The Kirkland Facebook is open on my desktop, and some of these people have pretty horrendous Facebook pics.
Oh no!
Billy Olson's sitting here and had the idea of putting some of the pictures next to pictures of farm animals and have people vote on who's hotter. Good call, Mr. Olson. The first thing we're going to need is a lot of pictures. Unfortunately, Harvard doesn't keep a public centralized Facebook, so I'm going to have to get all the images from the individual houses that people are in. Let the hacking begin.
Now, one of the things that I think is bold about the film is that clear thing at the beginning. This is your introduction to this character. He's horrible. I mean, he's horrible in as much as he's basically lacking in social grace and is somehow taking that out on the internet. Now, during the course, there have been some things written about the film complaining that the film is misogynist. I think the film depicts misogyny quite clearly, but I don't think it in itself is misogynist. The other thing is that there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how much is a David Fincher film and how much an Aaron Sorkin movie. And people are saying that essentially the key thing here is Aaron Sorkin. People are very, very used to Sorkin's, you know, zingy one-liners. The fact that there's a story that his original script was, when they read through it, considered to be too long for the film. And so Fincher said, we'll just get everyone to talk faster because I don't want to cut any of the dialogue out. So at the very beginning of the movie, actually, when we have that initial conversation, the speaking is so fast that you have to tune your ear to it. Because, you know, when it begins with Zuckerberg and his and his partner breaking up, and the level of talking is very, very sort of snappy. And the whole thing carries on all that way through the movie. You do actually tune into it. I think that's perfectly fine. However, I would argue that it's clearly within the canon of David Fincher's movies. I mean, for example, if you look back at something like Zodiac, which is based on a true story, based on the novel, but based on the book by Robert Graysmith, is a sort of recent history piece with recent period history done by a director who's very, very focused on detail. He's painting a very broad canvas, but he's taking this story all the way through all its labyrinthine twists and turns. It's also, in the manner of something like Fight Club, a film about men with men and about the way in which men behave with other men and about all the, you know, the horrors and the repugnances of that, and that's perfectly fine. Also, clearly, from the minute the film opens, the visuals of it, you couldn't mistake them for being David Fincher. It's an external shot of this college. It's that kind of brown green. I mean, this is shot by Jeff Cronenworth, who I think shot Fight Club, who's worked with Cronen, but who's worked with Fincher before. So all those things tie together and clearly make it, in my opinion, into a David Fincher film. As much as, you know, people are referring to Aaron Sorkin's script, which is, you know, very motor-mouth, very fast. If you read it, it would be a very, very long book, and every line would be quotable. But it is primarily a Fincher film. What Fincher manages to do, which I think is quite extraordinary, is to make the most interesting film about a bunch of essentially horrible, overprivileged, unpleasant people sitting in rooms arguing about copyright and occasionally going online. Now, that in itself is a triumph. There are false notes. There is a moment about two-thirds of the way through the drama when it's almost as if the filmmakers themselves have lost faith with being in the rooms, and we go to a boat race, and suddenly it turns into this moment which looks to me almost like a commercial for Old Spice. It's with that tilt-shift lens thing, which one particular bit of the screen is in focus and the rest isn't, and you suddenly get this scene of this of the, you know, these rowers surging through the water, and it almost felt like, we've got to get out, we've got to take it out somewhere. It's like when they take a play and they put it on the screen, you felt like it was expanding. It didn't really need to do that. That's the first one. The second thing is that the film does have a, and I mentioned this to Aaron Sorkin, but it does have a big chubby hum moment. And you remember chubby hum you're going to say, what is it, right?
Yeah, what is it? And it's something that doesn't exist anyway.
No, it does exist.
No, it doesn't. If you watch the original, anyway, explain what it is.
Okay,
and then
chubby, yeah, fine. Chubby hum is a phrase that was coined by John Ronson. Credit where it's due. And John Ronson and I were having a drink one evening, and he said,
another one.
Yeah, exactly. And we came up with an idea for a program, which was chubby hum is the moment in a film based on real events in which the person or persons do the thing for which they are famous or are seen generating the thing for which they are famous. And it comes from, in John's memory, a moment in the Karen Carpenter story when Karen Carpenter opens a copy of Billboard magazine to read a review of the new Carpenter single. And she says something like, what does it say about me? And Richard says, oh, it says something like the chubby drummer kept time. And Karen Carpenter goes, chubby? And suddenly the next thing, yes, you know, this is explaining the
anorexia. Except that she doesn't.
Except that actually she doesn't quite do that. No, John slightly misremembered it, but it didn't matter. It became then shorthand for the moment in The Doors when the Ray Manzarek character played by Karl McLachlan goes, da-da-da-da, hang on a minute, da-da-da-da. You guys go outside.
The problem with that shorthand is by the time you've explained it, it's not really helpful. Anyway,
no, but there is a great chubby hum moment in Social Network in which somebody rushes up to Zuckerberg as he's putting this thing together and says, that girl that you've seen, she's in your class, and I need to know whether she's going out with somebody. I need to know what her status is. Is she with a boyfriend? Does she want a boyfriend? Does she want to be? Does she want? And Zuckerberg character goes, look, it's not like people walk around with a notice board on their. Hang on a moment, and then rushes to the nearest computer. And the next thing, he's invented Facebook and the social status thing. Now that is it's a moment that actually provoked laughter. I actually rather enjoyed the moment because it seemed to be almost knowing that they had to do that particular turn. So I think there are a couple of places where it's slightly wrong-footed. There are a couple of places when it breaks out of its, I mean, certainly after the boat race, it never quite recovers the momentum that it had before. And there is a desire at the end, I think, to humanise and take the edges off some of the characters in a way which I personally could have lived without. But for the most part, it's clearly a Fincher film. It's clearly a film by the guy who made Fight Club, made Zodiac, made Seven, I think, as well. You know, you could see that. I can't see much of Alien 3 in it, obviously, but that's because he had Final Cut. And what I like about it is a film which isn't scared to say these people are interesting, but they're poisonous.
And here's the point. If Aaron Sorkin scripted Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet, it would be a great film.
Yeah, but we would also think that Mr. Poopy was perhaps a morally ambiguous character as opposed to somebody who at the end of it learns an important lesson.
Russell?
No, just to quickly, did you enjoy Social Network?
I think it's fantastic. And the reason why is that if people are into Facebook and they really, and it's addictive, fantastic, exciting social tool, people love Facebook, they'll go and see this film and think, wow, this is really interesting, this happens. And if you can't stand Facebook and have no intention of being having a Facebook account like Aaron Sorkin,
yeah,
you'll think this is a fantastic film.
Because it's because as I've seen, and it says it's all poisonous and corrupt anyway. I mean, there is that great irony that in the past, well, certainly for those of us that are old trots, we always believe, oh, everyone's watching us, everyone's trying to, you know, we'd all go and make phone calls from phone boxes because, you know, nowadays you want any information.
You
want any information about us? It's all online. There we go. I'll just put it all up here. What am I doing? I'm a revolutionary Marxist and this, that and the other.
Russell Thompson, A Source Social Network on Wednesday. It's intelligent, engaging storytelling at its best. Great script from Aaron Sorkin, good central performances. The characters are complex and there isn't a divide between good guys and bad guys as there so easily could be. Only one character comes out of it completely badly, Sean Parker.
That actually is an interesting... I think the Sean Parker character is made...
By Justin Timberlake.
Played by Justin Timberlake very well. I feel that in the dramatic construction of it, he is made to be the fall guy. Yeah. I mean, I don't know him in real life, obviously, but there is that seems to be part of taking the blame away from the Zuckerberg character.
Russell concludes, the film was 2 hours. Any longer in the presence of Mark Zuckerberg and he would have become too annoying. Martin in Karlsruhe. Simon, a few weeks ago I happened to see a trailer for The Social Network, during which I thought, there is no way on earth I'm going to see a film about Facebook, until I saw that it was the new David Fincher film. Since Fincher is one of those directors of which I will see any film, even if it is, at first sight, about Facebook. I went and saw it last Sunday in OV, original version.
That's very good.
Is there any other version?
Well, is he seeing it in a foreign... territory.
Oh, I see. Okay, he's seeing it in Karlsruhe.
Duh.
So he's seeing it in English. The Social Network once more demonstrates that Fincher is...
Le
along
Network
with...
Social.
That's French, though.
Well, where is he from?
Karlsruhe, which last time I checked was in Germany.
I can't do it. What is it?
Don't. You'll just end up sounding like Joseph Goebbels. The Social Network once more demonstrates that Fincher is, along with Christopher Nolan, one of the great film storytellers of his generation. 120 minutes of dense drama, during which I was not bored for a second, but rather entertained and delighted with Sorkin's spot-on screenwriting and Fincher's crisp and inventive filmmaking. Even though the heart-killing thrills of Seven and the extravagances of Fight Club are over, Fincher's more mature docu-fictional pieces...
Ooh!
Like Zodiac.
Oh!
Are up there to the same degree.
I should say as well that it...
Docu-fictional is not a word.
No. It is also a special effects movie in that the Winklevi are played by... well, they are actually two actors. It's the main actor, Army, whatever his name is playing both the twins, but he's playing it with another guy who's standing in for the body for the other guy, and then they have digitally superimposed the face of one onto the other, which obviously puts you in mind of David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers. I mean, that's the thing that you immediately start thinking. But when I was watching the film, I didn't know any of this, and I actually nudged David, who's David? David Braithwaite comes up every year, and said... Are they actually identical twins? Because it's done so seamlessly, and it does remind us that the last thing that David Fincher did was a massively expensive special effects movie, which is Benjamin Button, in which Brad Pitt grows backwards for no purpose whatsoever, and a film which was totally crippled by this awful gushing sentimentality, none of which is in this.
Aled, final one on this before news and sport coming up in just a second, saw a preview of Social Network on Wednesday. I think it has to be one of the films of the year. It is a testament of quality, the script, that a film with so many unlikable characters,
yes,
with the possible exception of Andrew Garfield's Eduardo Saverin, remains totally compelling and captivating throughout. The acting was great. David Fincher proves what a great director he is by making the writing of computer code and hacking of some servers better than many action sequences.
Although not as good as the action sequences in Hackers, because as we said about Social Network, it's good, but it's not Hackers.
Here's an interesting one from David Romsey. No crowding. Cinema is 3/4 empty. Why have you sat next to me?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that.
Lee in East Carlton, we went to see Pray Love as a good husband gesture. My wife was suffering with us, as I think a number of people have done, actually. My wife was suffering with a strange stomach bug.
Eat, pray, love, bless.
And 1 hour in, she had to leave the theatre to throw up. So for us, it really was eat, pray, love, vomit. Udall Evans in Walthamstow. Oodle or Udall, anyway. I'm sure I'm not the only person to have written to you regarding Warner Brothers' quite frankly surprising announcement of part one of the Potter finale appearing 3D-less.
Yes, which is magnificent news. They've decided not to issue it in 3D, at least not in the initial release. They're saying that it will be 3D'd later on, but this is really hands in the air, clapping, punching the airtime, a major victory.
It does make me wonder how this company could not get their fingers out to make quite conceivably their most profitable movie to date. It is quite extraordinary that they couldn't actually get the 3D to work in time for the release.
No, you know, there's a reason for that. Retrofitted 3D doesn't work.
It is that simple.
It doesn't work. And hats off to them in the particular case of the initial for realizing, you know what, if it doesn't work, don't do it. I know they're still saying they're going to do it for part two and they are going to release it, but you know, I want it in 2D. It was shot in 2D.
Despicable Me is out this week.
New Digimation, US-backed European animators, voices of, amongst others, Steve Carell, Russell Brand, Julie Andrews. Story is Steve Carell is Gru, who is a fiendish mastermind who needs investment from the Bank of Evil. In one of the film's better jokes, the Bank of Evil brackets formerly Lehman Brothers. Boom, and if you will, boom. His main thing is that he's...
Was that a Dutch joke?
Boom, and if you will. No, that's not... I used to be able to do Paul Verhoeven, but I can't...
Sorry, I'm not asking you to do an impression. I apologise. Do carry on. Please don't pause.
Paul Verhoeven was once talking about... Okay, fine. Just bumping. That's what it is. So I've put myself off.
Exactly. Just get on with it.
Yes, he needs to do evil acts. He is not taken seriously by the Bank of Evil because of a newcomer called Vector, and his mother doesn't take him seriously either. Here's a clip.
Hello, Mom. Sorry, I meant to call, but...
I just wanted to congratulate you on stealing the pyramid. That was you, wasn't it? Or was it a villain who's actually successful?
Just so you know, Mom, I am about to do something that's very, very big, very important. When you hear about it, you're going to be very proud.
Good luck with that. Okay, I'm out of here.
What he wants to do is he wants to steal the moon, but in order to steal the moon, he has to steal a shrinking ray that will shrink the moon down to a size that he can get it in the spaceship. And in order to steal the shrinking ray, he has to adopt three orphans who make cookies which are liked by the person who owns the shrinking ray. So he adopts the orphans. Obviously, he's Despicable Me, but during the course of the drama in which he has to have the orphans to get to send round the robo cookies, do you think there's any possibility his heart will melt and he will discover that there is more to life than just being evil?
It sounds like it might be you're leading us in a particular direction. I think the answer might be yes.
So here's the thing with Despicable Me. Well, a few things to say about Despicable Me. First thing is that most of the ideas in it are at least second or third hand. I mean, the Gru character is basically Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies. I mean, he's got a use certificate with a bit of Igor thrown in. And Carell said that the voice he's doing is Ricardo Montalban meets Bela Lugosi. The moon stealing plot is anything from Dougal and the Blue Cat to certain bits of Wallace and Gromit, and actually some Tim Burton animation. Julie Andrews, I think, has been cast largely because she was in Shrek. The little yellow monster robots that help him seem to have wandered in from Toy Story, either from Toy Story or indeed from Monsters, Inc. And even the Bank of Evil joke looks like it's sort of left over from The Incredibles. I'm not saying that the film is disastrous in its construction. It's just, it is really quite shockingly unoriginal. And there's even the adopting the orphans thing, which is sort of a riff from Lemony Snicket's. The difference with Lemony Snicket's being, the reason Lemony Snicket's works, although probably the reason Lemony Snicket's wasn't a bigger hit, is that the central character doesn't actually have some lovely conversion and decide that children are wonderful. Actually, the Jim Carrey character in Lemony Snicket's is really horrible all the way through. Remember, the author of Lemony Snicket's came on the programme. And do you remember that?
Many years ago. In fact, no, I don't, but I'm sure you're right.
Oh, you talked to him as if you were a great fan of his work.
I'm sure I did. I perfected that art.
The other thing to say, that probably the most important thing about Despicable Me, is that it's released in 2 and 3D and was a watershed moment to some extent in the States, because in America at least, only 45% of the audience watched it in 3D, which meant that it was a turning point in, you know, everyone was saying, oh, 3D is the future, 3D is what's going to, you know, basically bankroll Hollywood from now on. And what was demonstrated was that people weren't interested. Now, in the case of the 3D in Despicable Me, it's completely irrelevant. It's so irrelevant that they have to do a 3D sequence during the closing credits in order to kind of justify the fact that it's 3D, because the 3D adds nothing whatsoever. It's, you know, if you think that the 3D in Toy Story...
Isn't there an Eat, Pray, Love, Vomit moment where the vomit comes out at you?
Well, that's not enough to justify the 3D.
Sounded quite fun.
Oh. Yeah. No. But it was... Now, I read a couple of industry articles in which people said, oh, no, that's completely wrong. The reason only 45% of the audience in America saw Despicable Me in 3D is because all the other 3D screens were full. And in fact, what it demonstrates is not that people have lost the appetite for 3D, but that we need more 3D screens in order to... There was a great article in the papers today, and this has been going around for a while, that, of course, as Christopher Nolan was telling everybody, the future isn't 3D. The future is IMAX, if anything. The IMAX format has had... No, it's important because the only interesting thing to be said about Despicable Me, except for the fact that it's derivative, it's bland, and it's nothing other than perfectly ordinary, is that it is, if you care to see it in this way, a watershed moment in the ongoing evolution or devolution of 3D cinema. And from where I'm standing, that's actually the most important thing about the movie. It's a tipping point. It's a flag. It's a marker. It's a line in the sand. It is nothing other than that.
What else is new?
Vampires Suck, a movie parody, and I use the word accordingly, on the Twilight series. Edward Sullen, Boom Boom, and Becca. You know the characters. Remember ages and ages ago, the two Ronnies did a sketch in which Ronnie Corbett dressed up as Boy George and sang, "Do you really want to squirt me?" It's like
that. I don't remember that, no.
Here's a clip.
Your skin is pale white. You dress fashionably. And you abstain from sex. I know what you are.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Jonas Brother.
That's right. Wait, what? Oh, I'm a vampire. Duh.
That was my next guess.
Okay, it's no surprise to know that it's terrible, awful, witless, boring, terrible. I mean, I paid to see it in the cinema this morning. I was there with some other people. There was one laugh, and it didn't
come
for me.
Why did you pay?
Because I wasn't at the... Because actually, I needed to go and see The American when the National Press Show was on, so that's fine. But I saw it with a paying audience, so I, you know, £7 worth of my life went down the toilet watching this. Here's the thing that you need to know about movie parodies, okay? Back in the day, you had the Airplane, right, which cost a very small amount of money, made a huge amount of money, and had jokes coming so fast that you never knew on screen exactly what to laugh at. Some while ago, Wes Craven, you know, he made the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. Then he made Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which was a postmodern take on the Nightmare series. Then he made Scream, which was a postmodern take on Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And then we had Scary Movie, which was a parody of a postmodern take of a postmodern take on Wes Craven. So it was already sort of three things down the line. And Wes Craven said, wow, things move fast in this town. The amazing thing about movie parodies at the moment is that they don't move fast in this town at all. They move incredibly slowly. Scary Movie was fantastically successful. And since then, we've had Date Movie, Epic Movie, made by, you know, had a string of these made by the people that bring us Vampire Sucks. And two things. Firstly, in terms of television parodies, you know, if you have, like on Mock the Week, something happens during the week, you can joke about it during that week because it's current, it's in the popular consciousness. Movies are slow to respond to some extent, not massively slow, but it is possible to miss the boat. Now, in terms of taking the mick out of the Twilight Saga, okay? The Twilight Saga has, it's not just that the ship has sailed, it's that the ship has sailed, gone across the Atlantic, hit an iceberg, sunk, been dragged up by, you know, at least one company, been turned into the biggest movie hit ever, is now currently being retrofitted for 3D for an anniversary re-release. I mean, we are three Twilight movies and four Twilight books down the saga. We are just waiting for the first part of it. It's like the joke, the whole thing about vampires are so now, that whole thing happened at least 18 months, 2 years ago. And it's no longer acceptable to say, oh, well, we're funny, we're responding really fast to something that's in the popular consciousness, because you're not. You're doing something which is a really old hat joke. Plus, just simply showing that you've seen the movie is no big deal. You know what? Loads of people saw Twilight. Loads of people saw Eclipse. Loads of people saw, you know, this is how it works. Loads of people saw New Moon. But what you have to understand is that the reason these films exist is simply because of the economics of them. I mean, look at these figures, right? Epic Movie cost $20 million, took $78 million. Meet the Spartans cost $30 million, took $84 million. Date Movie cost $20 million, took $60 million. This cost something like 1920, has already taken way, way more than that. It's a simple economics thing. Now, it's not good enough to just say these movies aren't funny, they're witless, stupid, dull, uninventive, they have no parody in them. They are simply saying, oh, we saw that film and here is somebody that looks like it making some crass gag which isn't even a gag. If you want them to stop happening, you have to stop paying for them, because as long as the sums add up, then the movies will continue to happen. It doesn't matter how talentless or, you know, foolish the filmmaking is. As a sheer economic proposition, it has It has no life outside of the economics. So here's what you do. You open your wallet and you look at your wallet and you go, do you want to do what I just did? I mean, I've just funded to the tune of £7 the next one of these horrible things. And unfortunately, what I've done is bolstered the box office enough to make them do it again, despite the fact that it's soul-crushingly terrible. But there's no point in getting worked up about it being soul-crushingly terrible. You just know that this is what these are nowadays. We are so far away from... I mean, even at the point of Airplane, you were working on the tradition of Kentucky Fried Movie and to some extent the National Lampoon's movies. Since then, this whole idea of the parody movie has fallen so much into disarray that to be surprised that it's anything other than utterly, you know, pustulant filth is surprising. It is simply an economic crisis. I have sinned. I paid £7 for it. This is partly my fault. And remind me when the next one comes out that I was one of the people who contributed to that.
I will.
Because I had to go see them, because there is no other way of looking at it.
And Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet would almost certainly be a better film.
Yes, and it would have, you know, been more interesting and probably would have cost less money and probably would have taken less money.
bbc.co.uk/5live on the homepage. 5live homepage will have part of our code of conduct, the new Wittertainment cinema going code of conduct. Code of conduct. We'll do this for a couple of weeks. We'll see where we end up with. It's going to be a cut out and keep thing. You can carry it with you in your wallet. You can take it to the cinema and ask them to post it up so that people will know how to behave in the cinema. Just on the subject of vampires, suck this from Andy, just reiterating some of your points. If ever you could review a film just by the trailer or the poster, this surely is it. This disturbingly unfunny spoof is the one. Clearly it's going to be terrible, but disturbingly I have just read that the film has already made back its budget domestically.
Oh, easily.
And that more people went to see this in the US than Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, no, well, that's absolutely true. So what that says is, why would you waste your money doing something that you're quite interested in, like Scott Pilgrim, when you can essentially... I mean, it's just lowest common denominator pornographic, you know, money-back film financing. That's how it works.
People such as the Wayans, the brothers, should not be allowed to pollute the screens any longer. Listen to The Good Doctor and vote with your feet. Although The Good Doctor has voted with
has
his
already
feet
voted with his own feet. As I said, the worst thing about this is I am soiled because I have paid.
We're carrying on with no Liverpool announcement just yet. I'm looking at pictures.
Over your city's grass will grow.
Journalists and photographers all waiting outside the offices of Slaughter and May, waiting for this statement where they have been for hours and hours. Who knows when it's going to happen? Let's carry on.
Over Your City's Grass Will Grow, directed by Sophie Fiennes, which is, it inhabits that strange land between documentary and installation, in that it is a film about art and an artist that is itself, to some extent, aspiring to the condition of art. I mean, occasionally...
I didn't understand a word of that.
Okay. This artist, Ansel Keefer, who built a small village around an abandoned silk factory in France... He's a German artist. And what he did was he basically built an environment for his artwork in which... I can't even do it. Yeah, exactly. For his artwork to be shown in. And he develops this very strange landscape, which begins with labyrinthine tunnels and then turns into buildings on the surface. And what happens at the very beginning of the film is that we see the cameras tracking very slowly through these strange tunnels. Light is allowed in only in certain pools, because a lot of his work is to do with light, or more accurately, to do with the absence of light. And the camera is tracking on a very, very smooth track. You think to some extent this is going to obviously set alarm bells ringing about Russian Ark, which I have to say I found very hard to get into. Or maybe Douglas Gordon, whose work, you know, like Zidane, I thought was not a film, was an art installation, and really, you know, didn't deserve to be in cinemas. After a certain amount of time, it develops into a documentary in which the artist discusses his work. He talks about a lot of his work being about the sea, about how the human blood is actually virtually seawater with red corpuscles in it. And then, most interestingly, we see the artist at work in a very, very sort of industrialized form of work, in which he has these paintings which are connected to and attached to sculptures. I mean, the thing about sculpture is that it's very physical. It's made by, you know, guys in construction hats, hard hats, with, you know, big, you know, shovels and picks, moving huge, heavy
You're
objects
doing the
around.
Whole village people thing.
And there,
well.
Yeah, they are. And there is one sequence in it in which we see a huge canvas, which is sort of like a woodland scene, and it's covered in what seems to be clay or chalk dust, or, you know, concrete dust, and it's laying down. And then what he does is he gets ropes to pull the canvas up so the dust falls away, revealing the picture that then looks behind it like you're seeing it through mist or as if it's weathered. And there's a motion in it, there's a movement in it as the dust falls away, which is one of those you go... Oh, that's, you know, that's really quite breathtaking. It's really quite beautiful. And then he says, bang the back of the canvas, because there's still some dust on it. Somebody bangs the back of the canvas and there's this explosion of dust comes away and the picture is revealed. And it's like if you worked really hard to make a very complicated CGI effect, you couldn't do that. And so at its best, what the film is doing is it's looking at the artwork and it's transmuting the artwork through the eye of the camera. And it's also giving you an insight into the artist's working process and what it is that he's interested in. I mean, it's interesting for me seeing it on film that so much of it looks like elaborate set dressing. And I don't mean that in a bad way, because I think set dressers, again, are some of the most underestimated craftspeople in the movie industry. There are certain sections of this exhibition you think, you could make a brilliant horror film in there. You could make a Tim Burton film in there. I mean, as the camera comes up above ground and we see these constructions of higgledy-piggledy houses sitting one atop the other. At times, I understand entirely that people go, okay, fine, I've been moving through a corridor very slowly on a very glidey track for a while. You know what? I'd like a car chase or, you know, an explosive conversation. So it is a film that does demand a level of interest and a level of patience. But the way in which the images fit with music is beautifully done. Bear in mind, as I keep saying, you know, melodrama is music plus drama is melodrama. So in that way, actually, there is something beautifully melodramatic about the film. I was very surprised. I have to confess that at the beginning, I felt kind of concerned because, you know, Russian Ark didn't do it for me. And I thought, OK, we're in art installation territory here. But by the end of the film, I was won over. And I did think it was a very accomplished piece of work that, for somebody who's pretty philistinic about art, as I was, am, it involved me and engrossed me and it took me through those tunnels in a way that I really liked.
Great, thank you. It's not going to be Movie of the Week, though, is it?
No.
I'm just checking.
Social Network.
Dear Doctor Who and Doctor Whom, Cinema Etiquette.
That's very good.
Cinema Etiquette, this is the Wittertainment Code of Behaviour. How about no sitting on 2-foot-high inflatable cushions, or no bringing an entire Chinese takeaway in multiple noisy and smelly cartons and pots, both of which I've witnessed at my local multiplex? It's from Paul, from Newcastle, but currently listening and emailing while beside a picturesque swimming pool, nursing an ice-cold drink on a sun-drenched Canary Island.
Very good.
Don't you love that?
Yes.
You're looking impatient.
I'm kind of relieved that I didn't. I thought at one moment I was going to have paid for the Vampires Suck and sat through it and then not be able to say anything.
No, you've done that.
I'm relieved now. This is the face of a relieved man.
Okay, so Despicable Me, George P, Mr. K is talking a total load of tosh. Despicable Me is great entertainment. 90-odd minutes just flew by.
Well, you know, as I said, I don't think it's terrible. I think it's remarkably unremarkable. And I think that the level of derivativeness is the thing that's kind of depressing about it. I'm surprised by how much money it's taken. I mean, it certainly has none of the timeless appeal of, you know, the Toy Stories or Monsters, Inc. or, you know, the best Digimations, digital animations, not allowed to say Digimations, apparently. No, I like the word Digimations. So I think it will be forgotten. I think it's a passing thing. I think it has nothing that will last or stand the test of time.
Are you all done on reviews?
Yeah, if you want me, yeah.
No, what I mean is, are there any movies that you're
No, that is it. There are only four out this week.
They're the ones. Okay, so the movie of the week would be?
It's Social Network. And I think to stress once again that the point that the listener who wrote in said, it's very, or maybe it was you, maybe it wasn't a listener, said, it doesn't matter what you think about Facebook, love it or hate it, the film itself will be interesting. As somebody who
I think it was me about half an hour ago.
It was you.
Thanks for listening.
Okay, sure.
That was Wittertainment for this week. Thank you very much indeed for staying to the bitter end. People might be expecting some sort of added thing at the end. So let me say that code of conduct, the Wittertainment code of conduct, is being updated constantly.
Yep.
And it's online, bbc.co.uk/5live, and you can read what people have said and you can add your own rules for the cinema. We will not tolerate this bad behaviour ever again.
What? Anton Corbin told me a Dutch joke. You want to hear it? A man went to the pub and the beer was expensive.
I think I'd rather watch Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet. But anyway,
in 3D.
We'll be back next week.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.